once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure, where you will hear Jake say at some point,
"And I think you'll like this."
Well, that was good.
That was the one time you're going to hear it, probably the whole hour. But
and,
you know.
And you can tell us apart because Jake is, as normal, wearing plaid and Jeff is wearing
plain.
See? So you can tell us apart. And you can also tell us apart by the color of our beards.
Yes. Jeff's beard is white,
brown.
mostly brown.
Well, a little speckles in it. He's working on it.
White.
However, if you depend upon the color of our hair, you will be very confused, particularly on top of our head.
Yes, because there is none.
Right.
Are none.
Yes. We both represent nothing in that area.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how hair can be both plural in a statement without the S on the end of it, as well as with the S on the end of it, it is also plural. So if you cut your hair, it's implied that you're cutting more than one. But when you talk about which hair,
you could
then
say
you
hairs.
Say hairs.
Right, and it also refers
it's very
to...
Very confusing.
It also refers to a member of the class Rodenta.
Yes,
which
the Rodentia.
Rodentia, which is actually different from rabbits.
Yes.
And even more different from jackrabbits, which are lagomorphs.
Yes.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you have now had your biology lesson for the day. You can go to sleep. Well, unless, of course, you
grammar
drive.
And biology for plurality of
I know
follicles.
Her. I know her. Grammar biology.
Grammar biology?
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. Almost said show. No, we don't have Gensu
Knives. No.
We also, Jake and Jeff, this is Jeff speaking, are also the principal managing members, I love that, it sounds like we're really somebody important, of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, and that firm, the Personal Wealth Coach, happens to be registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And we tell you all this because they are the organization that regulate us.
And if we say something really bad, you can complain to them.
And if you determine that we're irregular, then you can certainly contact them, and they will probably do nothing. No, that's not true.
They will do something.
So, but the telephone numbers, if you'd like to call in here to the radio program, Alter Ego of the Personal Wealth Coach, the locally in the area, it's 254-773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. We have a lot to talk about today.
You know, I was looking at the 773-1400 number and wondering why I have so much trouble with it. I realized I don't own or ever have contact with a single telephone of any kind where I can just dial 773-1400 or dial.
Yeah.
Forget dial. I can't even punch it.
Our office phones are voice over IP. Our cell phones don't do area code. Don't do no area code conversations.
If you just
put it in there.
If you just did like 773-1400 on area code, what would it do? I mean, on a cell phone, would it know, hey, I'm in the area 254? Would it just automatically do it? Or?
These are unanswered questions.
We could experiment with it. Do a survey.
I don't know if I want to try it because I might wind up talking to somebody in China.
You could. But speaking of talking to someone in China, we have a call on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, sir. A long-time listener.
You're not in China, though.
There's been a lot of talk by our president about income inequality and, you know, he's taking steps to raise the minimum wage for federal contractors. But I don't know. To me, unless you educate people more on how to manage money, I think most uneducated people think money is to spend. And even if they did.
That's the whole idea.
Wait a minute. Money to spend?
Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
How come you don't think we don't have more financial education programs in our schools?
I'll
hang up and listen.
I'm glad, because that's a deep question.
Yeah,
you know what's funny is I've got an article here on this.
I'm going to go back to the actual question.
I was going to talk about this today.
He said,
reading my mind again.
He said this, and I'm going to use his terminology. He said, how come we don't educate moron financial?
Now, I don't think that he meant moron.
But, you know, that's how we keep them from being morons. We educate them. So, yeah. I think that's quite appropriate.
You ask a question that's a very good one. Why don't we educate why don't we do a better job of educating? There's only 24 states in the United States that even have, at the high school level or below, any form of practical or financial education that goes on at the high school level. 22 of those require one class.
And most of that class is put up in balancing a checkbook, which we all know how many checks we write these days.
And the issue is that the teachers and the people who put the curriculum together haven't got a clue in that area. And they don't for a very good reason, and the same reason that the curriculi, or whatever it's called, that's put together, for instance, in the state of Texas, is generated largely by academics. Well, there's two groups of people who generate it, actually. There's academics and there's political activists. But let's go to the academics for a minute. There is a strange residual floating around out there in the form of government pensions, defined benefit pension plans, where the vast, vast majority of us will have to work in an environment where, if we are going to achieve that newfound in the late 20th century American dream of becoming wealthy, I'm writing a paper on this right now, so I could probably bore you to tears. But the point is that the American dream has evolved.
And we don't mean the Dream Act. We mean
the American dream has evolved to the point where we consider it every person's ideal, to become wealthy, truly wealthy. Wealthy means you have enough income from what you have accumulated or own or whatever that you don't have to work. And we think, okay, right around 65 or 67, which the majority of us are supposed to reach, we should be in a position we are financially independent, we are wealthy, we don't have to work. Now, that certainly doesn't work for everybody.
Do you know how rare that is in history, first? Let's just start there.
Yeah, like maybe that's the 1% everybody are mad at.
Yeah.
Okay?
Oh, yeah.
And it's not even 1%. It's a fraction of 1%.
If you lived that long, you probably would die for not working, and we take it for granted. This is something that we expect.
Well, at the beginning of the 20th century, the life expectancy in the United States was around 45, and the people who lived long enough that the average person, the normal person, except for the very, very wealthy elite, worked until they couldn't work, and they didn't live a lot longer than that, but their family then took care of them. Well, okay, come to the end of the 20th century, and we have already developed a tradition that the corporations and the government will pay for your retirement. Retirement's an interesting concept. The problem is, and now we realize that won't work because it's too expensive. So what we have to do now is manage our own investments to get to that position. The problem is the people who teach, the people who set the agenda for teaching, which they use a Latin word, which agenda is a Latin word too. But when they set the agenda, they have defined benefit pension plans. Somebody else is going to do that for them, so they don't need to learn it. They don't know it. And since it's not classical knowledge, the people in the colleges and universities don't understand it, so they're not going to teach it to the teachers, and the teachers are certainly not going to teach it to the students because they don't know it either.
All right. Let me take this back to tell you how backwards we are in the financial world. So I'm going to take this to history. This is part of the education that you're asking about. We, in the financial world, are roughly at the level of the mid-1600s in the physics world, what they called natural philosophy back then, where we're plotting points on a graph and coming up with very simple algebra and going, ooh, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Look, the Earth is this. We can predict where we're going to be in the orbit around the sun. We're barely,
getting to a point
there.
The Romans did that.
Well, yeah, that's true. But Newton developed a set of mathematics that could be applied to where we were in our rotation around the sun. Euclid was the first to kind of get that, but calculus came out of it. He and Leibniz, calculus came out of it. Well, we're building that, so we're only, 400 years behind the rest of science. And just like then, Isaac Newton had to fight the academics.
Academia.
I say even things like, I realize that you've got a sundial there that was made in Greece and it looks great, but it doesn't tell time. Here, this thing over here does, and they didn't want to look at it.
Well,
academia is kind of slow at accepting new things.
But even in Newton, even when Newton was well accepted, the average person certainly didn't understand physics.
Correct.
And matter of fact, the average person wasn't literate. And today, what happens is the academic institution that drives teaching, that drives the education process, is unfortunately, like many other ossified institutions,
oh, I like that
very
word.
Very slow. You missed that excellent opportunity. But when our children were going through high school,
I missed that excellent opportunity.
Yeah,
that was great. I skipped high school.
Yeah, they were being taught Pascal programming language. Now, this is long after Pascal had ceased to be used as a programming language, but there was intensive teaching because the test, the SAT test, still had Pascal on it. So they were teaching to a test that was put together by academics several years earlier who thought, whoa, this is something. They wait for something to become established, and then they teach it. But there is no industry out there that is willing to lobby the educational institution, the education institution in the United States, to teach the elements of investment finance. They're not. Matter of fact, when they do teach finance in school, they don't teach investment finance. They just teach stuff that probably doesn't work but looks good. The issue is that it is in the best interest of the corporations to have people that don't understand investing, because they make a lot of money from selling things to people who don't understand even what risk is or what money for us.
Right. Here's the key, and this is something we could talk about this for the entire program, 2 hours, and then just keep right on going. Most economists before the Great Recession, if you ask them...
Oh, I love that term.
Right, the Great Recession.
The Great Recession.
Most economists, if you ask them about the American savings rate and debt rate, would say before the Great Recession, oh, it's very unhealthy. They need to save more and they need to have less debt.
Right.
Okay, today we've had quite a change since then. We're saving a lot more and we have a lot less debt.
It took was a really great recession.
Right, and if you ask most economists, they say, well, this is bad for the economy. What they need to do is get their credit cards out and start spending, which is to say that the experts in the field are split as to whether or not the overall economy is more important than the individual economy. And it's easy for us because we work at the individual level a lot, though we work also at the macro level where we're looking at the large picture. If we can educate people to recognize the big picture and take advantage of the lack of knowledge of other people to both educate them, this is Adam Smith here. If we educate everybody, the entire populace is going to be raised. The whole invisible hand thing
is
comes
that,
in
is
here.
Is it Aaron's brother?
Who?
Aaron Smith.
Aaron, no.
Oh,
no.
Okay. Right. Anyway, go ahead. Right.
So the concept here of capitalism rests in self-empowerment. So education is important. Well, that political activism, you mentioned this in passing. Most people that are activists do not like the idea of empowering an individual with the ability that they might have to hurt themselves. And if you think about George W. Bush's effort to privatize Social Security, he was going to take 10% of Social Security and say, this belongs to you, you manage it. And a whole side of the political spectrum came out against that and said, well, you're going to cause people to hurt themselves.
Yes.
And it's true unless you educate them too.
Well, the thing is, it takes a generation to educate. By the way, there are some very good studies on this issue that on the issue of privatizing even 10% of Social Security. It results in people losing their money hand over fist.
Right.
And financial service companies
Correct.
Becoming quite wealthy.
The reason is because the people don't know what to do with it when they have it.
But my point on, by the way, since we're on privatizing Social Security, leave Social Security just like it is. It's a pay-through system. Well, with the minor exception. By the way, 49% of Americans now believe, the last survey I read, that limiting benefits to the more wealthy people is the way to fix Social Security, which means that we're getting there very quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. But the point is that, okay, so they're paying into Social Security. Don't reduce that and give them that to save. If they're going to be educated, then they take 10% of the rest of their money, which, by the way, in a 401k program, in many cases they do, or a 403b, and invest that extra money so that you have a two-pronged approach to this thing. And well, I think that is, by the way, the healthy way to do it.
I think a TSP concept.
Hmm.
I realize, you realize, that the concept of the TSP is great.
By the way, that's the Thrift Saving Plan, which is a governmental program.
Yes. If you're a soldier or a military employee or a governmental employee, then you know what a TSP is. Otherwise, the rest of you, it is sort of like
it's a lisp without an L.
Yeah, it is the ugly stepchild of a 401k.
Right.
Very ugly stepchild. It doesn't have a whole lot of choices. But obviously, the government thinks that their employees are smart enough to know what to do with a TSP. So the concept of saying the rest of the citizens of the United States are not smart enough to know what to do with this, but for our employees here, have this. I think there's some issues there. Some form of privatization, but more importantly, going back to the original question, why are there so few resources for education in this area? And the reason is it's a for-profit industry. The entire financial industry makes its money on the fact
that people are more ignorant than the salesman.
People don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about this last week about, you know, fixed annuities.
We're going to talk about it some more this week.
Oh, yeah, we are. And the fact is that if anybody understood what they were getting into, most people, vast majority of people, would not get into those things.
Yeah, and we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Well, I have a cell phone, and I punched in 773-1400.
Yes.
No area code, and I got connected.
Well, congratulations. You have a smartphone.
No, it's actually 10 years old and pretty dumb. But
well, good.
You don't need education for your topic. You need to talk to your dad.
I could try talking to my dad, but, you know, there's a real shortage of mediums in the area. I've been looking lately for one.
We could have a seance.
We could have a
seance.
Yeah, but we need a medium.
Well,
I'm talking to my dad right now.
What you defined as wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm well over 70. I haven't worked in 12 years.
Right.
And it's a fairly simple lesson I learned from my father on how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, go to college and learn how to do mathematics.
Got it. That's
Good
number
job.
One. That's what
Perfect.
I was going to
you,
you're,
Great
you're
stuff.
Preaching to the choir.
And as soon as you do that, you understand the magic of compound interest,
mm-hmm.
and you get a real clue as to how to get ahead in life. The other lesson I got from him was live within your income.
Oh, wait a minute.
I'll guarantee you.
Well, actually, live within your means. Live within your means.
Yes.
Which makes you really mean.
Well, that's true. That's what my son used to call me.
let me stop just a moment and say the word live within your means here is quite appropriate because people's income fluctuates throughout their life. And if you look at the concept, you were just saying learn mathematics. The mean is a mathematical term.
Yes.
Your average income, live within that. If it goes up, stay below what you,
mm-hmm.
what your average has been. If you keep doing that, just like you said, this is not rocket surgery, folks.
No.
No, it's brain science.
Brain science.
Right, not rocket surgery.
Well, you're never going to learn it in school.
Well, you can.
They're not interested in teaching it in the first place. They probably never took even algebra or could pass it.
Well,
So they can't teach it. It's impossible.
Well, I would venture to say that the average teacher, every teacher has taken and passed algebra 1 and 2. But
well,
that doesn't mean that they
have
any concept.
Grandchildren, and the conversations with them are interesting. They can't do it. They avoid it. They'll do anything. They'll go into, oh Lord, the humanities or, you know, sociology.
Well, the point is to get out of get out of high school.
But mathematics.
But to get out of high school and go to college today, you have to pass Algebra 2.
Yeah.
That's good.
And but it's good, but the point is, and I object to that, by the way. I don't think, and you and I may disagree on this, but the point of learning Algebra 2 but not being taught investment theory doesn't make any sense to me, because the I have, very frankly, after I left Algebra 2, to this date, I have never factored an equation.
I have.
Yeah, I was an engineer by trade.
Well, okay.
I factor equations fairly regularly, actually.
And so my point is, and I don't have any objection to people who are headed in the direction of being engineers or math-related science, in that direction, going through Algebra 2 and trigonometry and calculus, and I think those are wonderful skills. What we're talking about here is those are mandatory, but most people never use them once they get out of school. Everybody, including the person who takes calculus, needs several years of investment management and theory, because their future well-being will depend on how well they understand that.
Well, I've got some great news here. This may be news that will shake a little bit of people's happiness, but what happened in Tennessee with Volkswagen's plant and the UNATO auto workers?
Oh, yeah. The United Auto Workers failed once again.
Right. This comes
really?
Back to education.
Did you hear that? They lost.
Wonderful.
They got kicked out of Tennessee.
Volkswagen invited the United Auto Workers in and facilitated the conversations that the United Auto Workers were having with the workers of this new plant.
Mm-hmm.
And had the vote. There were some political folks that came in and said, we don't think you should do it, it's going to raise the costs and so on. But I don't think that was the reason why the UAW lost this vote. And they did. They lost the vote by a margin, a pretty significant margin, about 10%
and they're forbidden.
Of the total voted more for one side than the other. So
right.
We're talking about like a 60-40 vote. It was a
715 to 654 or
right.
something like that. Yeah.
So the concept here of math and about education, if you just go back for a second, in Germany, they did a different thing with the unions than we did here. And with here, what we did is there was a lot of fight at the beginning. Unions came in. They said, we're going to fight for the workers. And the people said, hey, they've got a pretty good idea going there. It makes sense. These corporations are pretty well, I don't want to say any bad words here, but they're taking advantage of their employees. So we changed the law. Over a period of about 40 years, the United States changed its labor laws. And we did it so that unions aren't really a requirement mm-hmm. anymore. In Germany, they incorporated the unions into the law. They made the unions be the advocates for the worker instead of the government be the advocate for the worker.
There was incidentally a survey that was done of the workers after the vote.
Uh-huh.
Why the people who didn't vote for it had a very, very good thought process.
You know?
And it's an interesting thing. They like Volkswagen.
Yes.
And they like having a job, because Volkswagen came into an area where jobs were very, very scarce.
Uh-huh.
As the coal miners and everybody else got laid off.
Paying a very competitive wage.
And
across
the
nation,
you know what
a good wage.
You know what this is the fascinating thing, and I thought as a – I do institutional economics, so, you know, it's a
– Right.
The United Auto Workers is the majority shareholder at General Motors.
Right.
Which is competition to Volkswagen.
Yes.
So that's like saying, all you workers, what we want you to do is sign up with an organization that owns our competitor, and it's in the best interest of that organization to put us out of business.
Right. So let's go back a second just to simple math. Volkswagen came in and said, we're going to give not only a competitive wage, a good wage. If you look across the entire auto industry, they're paying at the upper end of that scale.
Right.
The United Auto Workers came in and said, we want to represent you. We want to give you a group voice. all we're going to do is take 15% of your income. and the worker said, wait a minute, 15 minus what? So I get 85% pay before taxes come out.
Uh-huh.
Wait, this is no longer a competitive wage. And so the unions are making the wages go down instead of up.
Right. What they would then lobby for an increase in wages from the employer.
Right. Just we'll just lobby to make them raise this already good wage up 15% more just to pay for us.
Yeah, but if you did, now this is the point. If they'd studied math, they would realize that a 15% increase after a 15%
still not
decrease
enough.
Doesn't get you
You're
back
still
to zero.
Less than what you were.
And the other things that they looked at was, you know, unions have become very political.
Very much so.
And the United Auto Workers has come out very, very strongly in a pro-abortion. They've taken a lot of positions that in Tennessee are anathema, which is a nice big word, okay?
Yes. And if you look at the split in the vote, you'll find that it very closely matches the Republican-Democrat split in Tennessee.
How did the women vote, or did they break it out?
Didn't break it out that way. Men and women are not voting that differently in areas like that. More and more we're seeing that the women who are working in an industrial environment like this one have a lot of the same views of the world that the men do. That is just one of those things. I don't know that there was a significant breakout between. I don't know that there was a difference at all between men and women in the votes there.
There is a difference between men and women.
There isn't, but not
that's
in the
scientifically provable.
So I just thought there was, from an institutional economics point of view, the United Auto Workers is definitely a dying organization.
Their membership has dropped 70% since 1972.
Similar to the stock drop of many otherwise healthy life insurance companies.
Yes.
Is there any industry unions in private companies have not destroyed?
Yeah. Southwest Airlines is completely unionized.
And they're doing great.
They work extremely well together. It's a collaborative approach.
That's a collaborative approach. It isn't the adversarial approach that most unions take. UAW is the leader in adversarial approaches to conversations when it comes to management.
Yeah,
but now, because they own a big chunk of General Motors, they are management.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. If the United Auto Workers own a big chunk of General Motors and they're supposed to represent the worker against the shareholder, because that's who management is representing. So management represents the shareholders, which a big chunk of are the auto workers union. And this seems like a conflict of interest
It's a massive conflict of interest, and it's going to result. I mean, the United Auto Workers is a classic case of an institution that's dying.
Yes.
As I recall, United Airlines in the 1990s did a buyout to the union, and they went bankrupt again later.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and American Airlines also was in continual conflict with its union.
Yeah, the pilots.
Uh-huh. And it's a matter of, and I've actually looked at this issue, and why does it work so well at Southwest and doesn't at the others? Fundamentally, I hate to load this completely on management, but it's largely on management.
It is.
The management of these major corporations, particularly, well, let me give you an American Airlines and United. American Airlines and United originally run by pilots.
Yeah.
And they were the ones who started a death spiral in the culture. Pilots in airline organizations in that era were very similar to surgeons in hospitals. They are an elite group who think that they are above everything else and everybody else should treat them as nobility.
Things have changed a bit since then.
And of course, what happens is a culture then develops in a corporation, and the culture of we are the pilots, we know what's best, the rest of you shut up and be really glad that we fly you around the sky attitude eventually results in a polarization, a maximization of profit for executives tends to polarize the workers away from them. And on the other hand, Southwest, which used to be Love, that's still its symbol, which flew out of Love Field in Dallas. I've only had one flew from Love to Hobby and Hobby to Love. But the point
Three
is
airplanes.
That in airplanes, Herb Kelleher started off from the beginning. First off, he's not a pilot. And secondly, he started off by ensuring that his employees all bought stock.
Yeah.
And they had the stock, and they had an ownership interest, and he developed consensus with the stakeholders in his organization before he would move on anything. That's just a different culture.
If you go back to the culture of General Motors before the collapse, I mean, if we recall, they flew out to D.C. to ask for the bailout, and they flew out in their private jets.
Dumb, dumb, dumb.
There is this hubris that grew in
one of my favorite words, hubris, yes.
The auto industry was so top-heavy. The 1970s, 60s, 50s, all the way up into the 80s, the American auto industry had zero competition in the rest of the world and very little against each other in the United States. They may have competed a little bit, but everybody knew what percentage of the populace was going to buy what kind of car. The competition went to almost nothing. This is where
Then the darn Japanese came along.
Right. The unions were saying, all right, we're going to build into all of our contracts this huge raise every year because we don't have any competition. You can just raise the prices. It's not a problem. Who else are they going to buy from?
And that's, by the way, where we got inflation.
Right. And so the 1970s, we have this huge inflation because these people at the unions are getting pay raises even though they are not creating any more value. And as I said, we've got 70% less people in the United Auto Workers Union than we did then, and I think we're right around 6 million mm-hmm. people in there. So if you think about that, that's just one union that had up around 15 million people in it. And if you add in the other unions, and they all had contractual pay raises, the unions became top-heavy because people in the unions, you know, when the union started, they were employees. All the people in the union were employees. The people that talked to management were employees of management. And then the union said, well, it's much more efficient if we get some people that don't have to be working all the time. They can spend all their time talking to management. So now you get executives at the union, and the executives at the union are getting paid a large amount of money eventually. There's organized crime involved. Then you have the corporate side of things, General Motors, who their debates with the union back and forth, they weren't telling each other the truth. The executives would say, well, if you take this pay raise, you're going to put us out of business. You're going to kill my grandchildren and so on, you know, the old haggling thing. And then unions got, okay, we don't believe what the management's saying. So when it came, they've called wolf enough times that General Motors failed because they yelled wolf, and there really was a wolf, and the union said, well, you've been yelling that for 30 years.
And the adversary, by the way, the thing that destroyed General Motors was the thing that's destroying Congress.
Yes.
Highly adversarial.
Polarization.
The high polarization applauded by the rank and file people represented.
Right. We don't care if we don't do anything as long as you stick to your principles.
We applaud the Jake mentioned something a minute ago that I wanted to come back to. Activists, whether they be on the left or the right or whatever they're activist for, typically want to tell everybody else that they should behave the way the activist wants them to behave.
Not the way the activist behaving, but the way they want them to.
And I don't care whether it's on the right or the left.
It doesn't matter.
Still a dictator.
And the point is, whether it's what's the equivalent of the Tea Party on the left?
You've got Occupy Wall Street.
Whatever.
The green folks. I mean.
Whatever. The point is
Greenpeace.
Both of them want a larger, more intrusive government. They want the government to force everybody to behave the way they think they ought to behave. And that's why I'm not on either extreme, and I guess that's my political statement. We got to play some commercials.
Yes, we do. Thanks for the call.
Appreciate the call. Good question. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back after these very important words from KTEM's sponsors. We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. And the telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
I was reading some very interesting articles in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's this morning.
I only read boring ones, so you'll probably be better talking about the non-boring and interesting articles.
Well, they were interesting to me. They said that the labor market may be tighter than thought, which means that people are probably spending too much time in pubs.
Tighter than thought. How tight is thought?
I don't know, but they said it was tighter than thought. I think they left out by many economists. The point is that among people in the United States with a bachelor's degree, the unemployment rate is 4%.
Correct. That is right at full employment.
Yeah, that's as good as it gets, folks. The people who have bachelor's degrees who are outside of the labor force, so they're not counted in that 4%, have a couple of things in common. I have several things in common. One, many of them have decided, just like the gentleman who just called in, he has a bachelor's degree at least.
Maybe.
Well, he's an engineer. By definition, he has a degree. So the point is that he isn't working anymore because he didn't have to.
Correct.
And the other thing that they noted is that the quality of jobs held by that group of people has improved since before the recession. And the reason was they got unemployment for a long time so they could take their time being picky about jobs. And this is really interesting. 23% of the small businesses in the United States report they have multiple job openings they are unable to fill. Did you get that? I want you to listen to that just as carefully. 23% of small business. Now, small business is not mom and pop down the street.
No.
This is maybe
50 employees.
50, even up to 100 employees. I don't know. It depends on your definition of small business. But you can have quite a lot of employees and still be a small business. And they have unfilled positions they are willing to pay people quite well, generally, to work in, but they cannot find qualified people to work there.
Let me tell you, the two areas of the world in the United States,
Wait a minute. There's two areas of the world in the United States. This is getting better. You're already out in left field.
Unemployment in the skilled area where we're talking about education required, we're talking about engineering, we're talking about chemistry, we're talking about programming, they cannot find enough people to hire. Mm-hmm. They are looking for the hard skills,
right, as opposed to the soft skills of, I have a degree in communications.
Right. Now you go to the other end of the spectrum.
Matter of fact, let me interrupt you here just a second.
Uh-huh.
I had an actual person say to me, I have a degree in communications.
It's a simile.
And some people are not going to understand what I just said, and if you didn't, you might want to ask somebody.
Yeah, all right. The other end of the spectrum is the zero skill required. We want you to come out and work manual labor, picking this crop or hammering without a nail gun.
Mm-hmm.
They can't find enough people. They're unable to get the work done that needs to be done because they don't have enough people to employ.
One of the things that I think I may have brought up, Alabama is still having a state of emergency in Alabama. Literally there are hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of chickens who have died because of this emergency.
It's a chicken emergency, and it's quite important actually on a macro scale.
They can't get enough propane to the farmers to heat the chicken houses. And believe me, in Alabama, that's big business.
That's a big deal.
Raising baby chickens. And you will probably see an increase in the cost of chicken in the near future as a result of this. Now, what's the problem? Are the pipelines not carrying enough gas or whatever? Turns out that the pipelines are carrying enough gas.
Yes.
And at the distribution points at the end of the pipelines, they have adequate propane in the tanks.
Yep.
The problem And they're not buried knee-deep in – well, they got some snow. But
not knee-deep.
Even before the snow, they were having this severe problem.
It's available to get.
They didn't have enough people who would be willing to work the long hours in the cold delivering the propane. And the reason they did – and this is directly related, it turns out.
Very much so.
To a law they passed requiring the police, any police officer, state or local, who suspected a person – might not be a legal resident of the United States to detain that person until they could prove their legal residency, which, by the way, most of us can't do. Unless you're carrying a passport, you can't do it. The problem that occurred was they singled out, of course, people who had Hispanic accents and dark skins. And whether it is, unfortunately, many people who have Hispanic accents and dark skins and who are perfectly legally in the United States, born here or whatever, unfortunately, a lot of them don't have passports. And as a result of not carrying a passport with them, they got put in jail until they could prove they were a citizen. Guess who fled the state in droves?
Yeah, this is something we actually predicted. There's two big predictions, and we made them on the same week. This is great. So this was several years back. This was the time period that Congress was discussing ethanol in gasoline, because the Republicans wanted to have a energy independence, and the Democrats wanted green energy. So they said, hey, here's a good thing. What we'll do is something. We're going to have a compromise. We're going to put 10% ethanol in the gasoline, and the farmers of the United States are going to prosper out of this. They're going to make lots of corn, and they're going to make alcohol out of the corn, and look, it's going to be great for everybody. Except that it raised the price of corn and wheat. It caused riots in Mexico because tortilla prices went through the roof, and it caused the Arab Spring because bread became so expensive in northern Africa.
And it also caused the Syrian civil war.
Right. So good intentions sometimes have really bad consequences. In the case of Alabama, what they did is they did not do a survey of how many people it would impact when they said, make sure that they are a legal immigrant. Now, whether or not they're legal or not, whether or not you want to call them illegal immigrants, whether or not it is right and good to have someone here breaking a civil law is irrelevant to this conversation. And people get their political mind into it and say, oh, well, you know, they got to follow the law. When we're measuring the economy and we look at the impact economically of a law being passed, and anybody that's listened to us for any length of time knows that we have said, if you start enforcing immigration law the way it's written right now, the cost at the hotel, the restaurant, For real estate construction.
And for chickens.
And for chickens.
And for beef.
Basically, you go down the line of all the things that unskilled people do, all of those prices will go up. Nobody really wants that. So the question is, what is the reality that we're dealing with? The reality that we're dealing with is economically, we Americans are voting with our dollars, and we want cheaper products. We want chickens that are not expensive. We want beef that's not expensive. We may politically say the opposite, get rid of all illegal immigrants. But recognize that when you're doing it, that's called a dichotomy. It's when you have two completely opposing ideas living very comfortably in your mind because you don't even know that they oppose each other. Get comfortable in your mind and recognize that those dichotomies exist. That if you really want the political statement of get rid of all illegal immigrants, then expect to see prices rise. If you don't want the prices to rise, then we need to change the law. I think right now we're living in a place where we're just lying on both sides of our mouth.
Let me give you an example of this. Many of you have noticed that the price of beef in the supermarket is much higher than it used to be.
Correct.
I couldn't understand that because we've had droughts. And what happens in droughts is farmers sell a lot of cattle. Now,
got to get rid of them.
So during a drought, normally, everything else being equal, the price of beef should drop like a rock.
Because you got to get rid of all these cows. You can't feed them anymore.
Once the drought has extended for a really long time.
Then beef prices go up.
Then we could see beef prices go up. But what we're seeing is that the sell-off process, particularly in California, is still underway. So why is the price of beef so high? So I got to digging into that. And the reason the price of beef went up...
Mm-hmm. Hold on, I've got my boots on.
...is because President Obama... It's Obama's fault.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot, Obama.
...has been the most aggressive deporter of illegal aliens in the history of the presidency. He has figured out that illegal people who are here illegally come here because they can get a job.
What?
So he's going to the places where the jobs are, which, by the way, an awful lot of people who are here without proper documentation work in meat packing and slaughtering plants.
Yeah.
Because it is really hard, nasty labor, and it's really, really difficult to find other people to do that. And so the Immigration and Naturalization Service started making raids on packing plants, which is where they slaughter and process the beef. They shut down packing plants all across the Midwest, so we've had a significant decrease in our manufacturing capability and capacity. By the way, that's part of why manufacturing, because that's a manufacturing
right.
plant.
They've got to transport the beef much greater distances mm-hmm. before they can be slaughtered, which is expensive.
But there's not even enough facilities in the United States to do all the slaughtering that's needed, so... This, what it boils down to is there's a deep constriction in the supply chain on beef because we have decided to crack down on people who are here illegally.
This is another statement. We talk about this regularly, but this is a great example of how people have asked us about this question a lot, about the statements that we make, where we say most presidents, when they get to the presidency, tend to do the opposite of their political party. And if you look at Barack Obama, more marijuana raids have been done in legal areas than in just a few years than all of the Bush years combined. More illegal immigrants have been
deported
in the first 4 years of the Obama presidency. More illegal immigrants were deported than in the entire 8 years of the Bush presidency, and that included a time when there were more illegal immigrants here under the Bush presidency.
Yeah, in other words,
a lot of them left during the recession.
It's a fascinating, everything has economic implications, and often, as Jake was saying, we have this tendency to take an economic position that when the result, we take a political position that when the economics of that decision come down to us, slam us. We could go on about this, but
yes.
We're running out of hour.
Yes, we're out of our hour. The next hour is coming up, but if you would like to contact us off the air, we do get a lot of fodder for the show from people sending us emails and calling us and leaving messages and such. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
947-1111.
We also have voicemail at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts of this in case you weren't bored enough by listening to us the first time. You can get rebored and listen to us once more on our podcast,
so,
thepersonalwealthcoach.com.
To close out the hour, we'll just make a short report here that, in case you didn't know that, by the end of this week, stocks were up generally about 2% on the major exchanges in the United States. We are very near record highs that were reached at the end of 2013. And for whatever it's worth, and I think we'll talk about this next hour, we've actually had a host of very, very, very positive economic reports this last week.
If you have a host, do you have a parasite? That's a question.
Well, I think there's some parasitic issues out there, but that's beside the point. So we are we continue to be optimistic, and until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.